25. Long Clove Mountain, New York, September 22, 1780, 1 a.m. Benedict Arnold's treachery has begun. Now the commanding general at West Point, he steps out from a thin forest of fir trees and onto the banks of the Hudson River. A rowboat, its oars wrapped in sheepskin to ensure total silence, eases up to the shoreline. Major John André, the dashing British officer who once courted Arnold's wife, Peggy Shippen, steps out of the boat. To avoid traveling in disguise and thus being treated as a spy should he be captured, Major André wears his crimson officer's uniform under a thick blue watch cloak. The war is now 5 years old, and it has been 16 months since Benedict Arnold approached the British about betraying his country. The drama leading to this moment has consisted of equal parts caution and audacity, culminating with Arnold brazenly stating that he would resign from the military unless George Washington gave him command of West Point, the most strategically vital fort in all of America. His Excellency, not wanting to lose one of his top generals, agreed. André and Arnold step back into the woods, away from the boatmen. The American general quickly gets to the point, handing over a bundle of documents that will allow the British to seize West Point, estimates of manpower, location of troops and artillery, and a top-secret record of George Washington's last council of war, held on September 6th, which details the Continental Army's upcoming battle plans. Most important of all, Benedict Arnold hands Major André complete descriptions of the four forts constituting the West Point fortress, specifically pointing out where they might be most easily attacked. Left unsaid is that Arnold has intentionally weakened these fortifications by neglecting necessary repairs and improvements. His troops are scattered across the fort rather than concentrated at the weak spots. Also, making an attack easier for the English, Arnold has ordered a link removed from the heavy chain now strung from one side of the Hudson River to the other to stop British shipping. Footnote: the Great Chain across the Hudson stretched from Constitution Island to West Point. It was 600 yards long. Each link weighed 114 pounds and measured 2 feet long. A series of log rafts along the length of the chain provided buoyancy, ensuring that the chain did not sink below the surface and thus prevented enemy ships from sailing upriver. First installed in 1778, the chain was removed each winter to avoid its destruction by ice. Several links of the Great Chain can still be seen in a monument at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point. End footnote. Enemy victory will be as easy as sailing up the river and landing troops. André is impressed. In order to ensure Arnold's treason, he offers a cash payout equal to $50,000 in gold and a rank of brigadier general in the Royal Army. Arnold is not impressed. 30 miles downriver in New York City, British ships and troops are getting ready to sail upriver. The mission will begin as soon as André returns. The battle plan is designed to hide Arnold's treason. The British will assault West Point, and a besieged Arnold will request reinforcements from George Washington, but will surrender before any help can arrive. However, the ego of Benedict Arnold does not allow him to settle for André's offer. He demands more, suggesting that King George should grant him lands and a noble title if the British are successful. Major André can make no such promise, and the tense discussion drags into the night. Hours pass. It is crucial for the secrecy of this arrangement that André be rowed back to the Vulture, the British sloop anchored downriver, before sunrise. Traveling by ship is the only guarantee that André can safely return to British headquarters, for the overland route is choked with rebel militia who are aggressively looking for the British. The deal is not done, and André refuses to leave. Intelligence sources have confirmed that George Washington is now on his way to West Point. If the British can synchronize their attack with the general's arrival, the war will most surely end, and André will then be the hero. He must conclude negotiations with Arnold. When the sun rises on the horizon, it is obvious that André cannot be rowed back to the Vulture until night falls once again. He reluctantly makes plans to ride through American lines to spend the day resting at a safe house 4 miles away. General Arnold has prepared for this eventuality and has brought with him a spare horse for André to ride. The Major well remembers the last instructions of his superior, Sir Henry Clinton, prior to the start of the mission. Don't cross American lines. Accept no documents from Arnold that could incriminate you if captured, and don't change out of your uniform or risk being hanged as a spy. Disobeying the order, André accepts documents from Arnold within moments of their meeting. With daylight now established, André and Arnold ride into American-held territory and toward the town of Haverstraw. Major John André has now disobeyed two of General Clinton's orders. By 10 a.m. on September 22nd, he and General Arnold finally come to terms at a small house in Haverstraw. But André's escape is now in jeopardy. American cannon firing from the shore have laid waste to the Vulture, forcing her to withdraw downriver to safety. That leads to more disobedience, as André must now navigate the back roads of the New York countryside to return to New York City. A pass issued by Arnold will guarantee safe passage for Mr. John Anderson. For the ruse to work, however, Major André cannot wear the uniform of an officer of the British Army during his flight. General Arnold offers him a plain set of clothes to wear instead. By the rules of warfare, André is now officially a spy. About 8 hours later, tucking Arnold's documents of betrayal into his boots, Major John André sets out for New York City under cover of darkness. George Washington feels confident. On the morning of September 23, 1780, he rides out of Hartford, Connecticut with the Marquis de Lafayette, Alexander Hamilton, and the rest of his staff. Footnote: Washington traveled light and fast, his party numbering just a handful of staff plus his bodyguards. End footnote. The general has just concluded some very fruitful negotiations with America's French allies, in which he has been promised extensive ships and soldiers at this vital juncture in the war. There is a growing belief that the British can be defeated through a well-coordinated offensive. At the same time, it is acknowledged that the enemy is far from beaten and could win the war with a few effective moves. Several scenarios of attack were discussed at the Hartford meetings, all of them incumbent on combining rebel ground troops with French naval might. This is the first ever meeting between Washington and the Comte de Rochambeau, his French military equal. They are both keen to defeat the British Navy in New York, gain control of the harbor, and then launch an invasion of the city. The key to the attack is West Point. Thousands of rebel soldiers and large amounts of supplies vital to the war are maintained there. Its fortifications must be powerful enough to repel a British assault. If West Point were taken by the enemy, American and French troops would be unable to invade New York, as British forces would be massed to the north, waiting to launch a counterattack. In all likelihood, the British could then surround the rebels and their French allies, a catastrophe that could spell doom for the American cause. So it is that General Washington desires a first-hand look at the West Point fortifications to reassure himself that all is well. The general and his staff gallop along the upper road from Hartford to West Point. A chance meeting with a French diplomat in Fishkill, New York, causes Washington a short delay. The Chevalier de la Luzerne is an old friend, an envoy sympathetic to the rebel cause. It was the 39-year-old Luzerne who loaned his own money to help feed Washington's troops during the harsh winter at Morristown. So when Luzerne enthusiastically requests some time with Washington, the general reluctantly delays his trip. At first light on September 25th, Washington and his aides ride hard for West Point. The distance is just 26 miles. Washington orders two young officers to ride ahead and instruct Arnold's staff to prepare a meal. Afterward, Washington will take a personal tour of the fortifications with General Arnold. Washington arrives at Arnold's headquarters across the Hudson from West Point at 10:30 a.m. His Excellency is in a rare mood, sensing, after 5 long years of conflict, that victory is within his grasp. The thought of seeing Arnold once again also fills him with confidence. Despite the many headaches that come with such a tempestuous commander, Washington knows that Arnold is a man who will fight, unlike General Horatio Gates, whose retreat in South Carolina has actually heightened Arnold's stature. General Washington steps into the wood and stone house serving as Arnold's headquarters. It once belonged to a loyalist, but was confiscated by the Americans. He finds it odd that Arnold has not come outside to greet him personally, but is reassured by the sight of Arnold's wife, Peggy, who is as beautiful and poised as ever. Washington is informed by a young major that General Arnold sends his regrets. He has been called away to West Point temporarily, but will soon return. An hour passes with no sign of Arnold. Washington is then rowed across the Hudson to inspect West Point, and still the fort commander does not show himself. This initially pleases Washington, just as surely as the natural beauty of the Hudson River Valley and the site of the majestic fortress at West Point. "On the whole, I am glad that General Arnold has gone ahead," Washington comments. "He will give us a salute, and the boom of the cannon will produce a fine effect among these mountains." But there is no salute. Washington's irritation grows. He enjoys the occasional show of respect. On this day, reveling in the combined power of the Americans and French at his disposal, he is insulted by Arnold's rude behavior. His temper increases when Arnold is not there to greet him at the dock. "Is General Arnold not here?" he demands of the officer there. "No, sir," comes the reply. "He has not been here for 2 days, nor have I received any word from him." "This is extraordinary," Washington responds, his curiosity aroused. After seeing for himself the shocking dissipation and disarray of the West Point defenses, General Washington is rowed back across the Hudson. There is still no sign of Arnold, a mystery now in need of an answer. "On my return to his quarters, he was still absent," Washington will explain to Congress. In the meantime, a packet had arrived from Lieutenant Colonel Jameson announcing the capture of a John Anderson who was endeavoring to go into New York, with several interesting and important papers, all in the handwriting of General Arnold. This was also accompanied with a letter from the prisoner avowing himself to be Major John André, Adjutant General to the British Army, relating to the manner of his capture and endeavoring to show that he did not come under the description of a spy. But the question remains, where is Benedict Arnold? It was at breakfast, just after dawn, at the precise time General Washington and his staff made their journey from Fishkill to West Point, that Benedict Arnold was handed the note that would change his life. He was seated at the table in his home with the 2 young officers Washington had sent in advance, enjoying his morning meal with them. Arnold read the note from Lieutenant Colonel John Jameson, taking great care to conceal the growing sense of panic within, for he was most assuredly about to be found out. In reporting the capture of a British officer by 3 members of the New York militia, Jameson, a Virginian in command of the outpost in North Castle, New York, was following routine military protocol. The enemy officer was taken into custody and was now being held outside the village of Tarrytown, New York. André had a pass in Benedict Arnold's handwriting, and that was what led Jameson to alert Arnold. Jameson said he was planning to return André to West Point for questioning. Arnold continued eating his breakfast as if nothing had happened, yet his stomach was churning. At the moment, Arnold was the only officer privy to Jameson's note. With Washington just hours away, that would change, for Jameson would surely want to make the commander-in-chief aware of the British prisoner and the documents in his possession. Benedict Arnold stuffed Jameson's note into his pocket and finished his meal, excusing himself by stating that the letter was an urgent summons to his post at West Point. He called for his horse. He then walked upstairs to speak to Peggy, who was dressing for the coming breakfast with George Washington. She was 4 months away from giving birth to their second child, and their infant son was sleeping in a nearby crib as Arnold hastily explained that he had to run. The most important thing was immediately to reach British lines. He didn't know when or if he and Peggy would ever see each other again. Above all else, Arnold told his wife, she should not let on that she knows a thing, thus putting her own life in danger. Shocked, Peggy fainted. Arnold carried her downstairs, asking the young officers to look after his stricken wife. He then galloped his horse down to the Hudson, where he took a seat in his official barge and asked to be rowed out into the river. To the surprise of the men at the oars, Benedict Arnold was not going to West Point. Instead, he directed them south to where the Vulture, now out of cannon range, waited patiently for the return of Major Jean André. At about 11 a.m., came alongside a rebel boat from West Point, the ship's master of Vulture wrote in the log for September 25th. Found it to be General Arnold, who gave himself up. Arnold has betrayed me, a devastated George Washington tells the Marquis de Lafayette. Whom can we trust now? The general moves quickly. By evening on September 25th, he takes charge of West Point. There is not a moment to waste. Men whom Washington personally considers trustworthy are placed in command. Soldiers are immediately stationed at the weakest parts of the fort, and troops whom Arnold sent into the forest to cut wood, thus weakening troop strength, are recalled to battle stations. Washington then orders that Major Jean André be transferred to West Point for questioning. Later that day, under a flag of truce, a letter is brought to General Washington. On board the Vulture, September 25th, 1780, reads the heading. Sir, the heart which is conscious of its own rectitude cannot attempt to palliate a step which the world may censure as wrong. I have acted from a principle of love to my country. I have no favor to ask for myself. I have too often experienced the ingratitude of my country to attempt it. But from the known humanity of Your Excellency, I am induced to ask your protection for Mrs. Arnold from every insult and injury. I beg that she may be permitted to return to her friends in Philadelphia or to come to me, as she may choose. The letter concludes, I have the honor to be with regard and esteem Your Excellency's most obedient, humble servant, Benedict Arnold. Peggy Shippen Arnold feigns ignorance of her husband's treason. In fact, when George Washington returns to the Arnold home on the afternoon of September 25th, her tactic is to place all blame on George Washington before dissolving into tears and hysteria. Footnote: Alexander Hamilton described this scene in a letter to his fiancée, Elizabeth. I saw an amiable woman frantic with distress for the loss of a husband she tenderly loved, a traitor to his country and to his fame, a disgrace to his connections. It was the most affecting scene I ever was witness to. She, for a considerable time, entirely lost her senses. The general went up to see her, and she upbraided him with being in a plot to murder her child. One moment she raved, another she melted into tears. Sometimes she pressed her infant to her bosom and lamented its fate occasioned by the imprudence of its father in a manner that would have pierced insensibility itself. All the sweetness of beauty, all the loveliness of innocence, all the tenderness of a wife, and all the fondness of a mother showed themselves in her appearance and conduct. We have every reason to believe she was entirely unacquainted with the plan, and that her first knowledge of it was when Arnold went to tell her he must banish himself from his country and from her forever. She instantly fell into a convulsion, and he left her in that situation. Peggy was allowed to return to her father's home in Philadelphia. At first, she was treated with great sympathy, for few believed she had been in on the plot. However, when the contents of Benedict Arnold's personal letters were studied, there was enough evidence of her role in the conspiracy that authorities demanded that she leave Pennsylvania and be returned to her husband in New York. End footnote. Major Jean André knows he is in mortal danger. He is 30 years old and considers his life to have been devoted to honorable pursuits, and stained with no action that can give me remorse. But as a military tribunal meets to discuss his fate at the Continental Army's camp in Tappan, New York, just a few days after his capture, there seems little hope that his life will go on much longer. In hindsight, André's journey was initially uneventful. General Arnold had assigned him a local loyalist named Joshua Het Smith as a guide. It was Smith who provided André with the clothing he wore as a disguise. As the major rode through the New York countryside astride a black horse, in an old purple coat and tattered beaver fur hat, he hardly looked like a British officer. The great cloak thrown over his shoulders hid his appearance even further. The letters from General Arnold were concealed in the soles of his stockings. However, a trained eye would have noted that the breeches and white-topped boots he wore were more in line with those of a British officer than a backwoods American. On the morning of September 23rd, despite knowing that André would soon be entering an area frequented by cowboys, local thugs fond of stealing cattle and otherwise harassing the populace, Joshua Het Smith left André, fearing for his own safety. So it was that, at 9 o'clock that morning, three such cowboys were surprised by André's approach as they played cards alongside the road. John Paulding, David Williams, and Isaac Van Wart were all members of the New York militia. Paulding had just escaped from a British prisoner of war camp, having stolen a Hessian soldier's clothes to facilitate his breakout. He was still wearing the coat when Major André addressed the three men. Even though Paulding had leveled a musket at the approaching traveler, André foolishly said, "Thank God I am once more among friends. I am a British officer out in the country on particular business and hope you will not detain me any longer." Immediately, Paulding grabbed the bridle of André's horse. "We are Americans," he said, "and you are our prisoner." 6 days later, André now stands in a Dutch church in Tappan, facing the military tribunal that will decide his fate. Among the judges are the Marquis de Lafayette and Baron von Steuben. A letter from General Washington is read aloud, stating the charges and asking for a hasty resolution. The board listens as André defends himself, admitting every charge against him to be true. It is the agreement of everyone present, Washington included, that André is a gallant young officer. He has shown himself to be honorable and courteous. However, the verdict is clear. André is a spy. Agreeably to the laws and usages of nations, it is their opinion he ought to suffer death, a transcriber writes. General Washington agrees, setting the moment for André's hanging at 5 p.m. on October 1st. Major André is shocked, fully expecting to be returned to the British in a prisoner of war exchange. However, it is also common knowledge among officers on both sides that an American of the same elevated status, Nathan Hale, was hanged without ceremony by the British earlier in the war. But John André does not show his surprise. André met the result with manly firmness. Alexander Hamilton, who witnessed the trial, will later write of the verdict. George Washington does not want to hang Major André. He would much prefer to execute Benedict Arnold, but André is the one who was captured. Washington is utterly furious about the betrayal and would love nothing more than to see Arnold stretch a rope, so he offers the British a trade. André for Arnold. General Henry Clinton has a deep fondness for Major André, and a flurry of letters is exchanged between the generals in which the American concedes to an English request that his hanging be delayed in order that an agreement be reached. But the British finally refuse to exchange Arnold for André. Knowing the end is near, the Major makes a final plea to Washington. He requests death by firing squad rather than hanging. "Sir, buoyed above the terror of death by the consciousness of a life devoted to honorable pursuits, I trust that the request I make to Your Excellency at this serious period, and which is to soften my last moments, will not be rejected." Sympathy towards a soldier will surely induce Your Excellency and a military tribunal to adapt the mode of my death to the feeling of a man of honor. Even after Alexander Hamilton pleads that this is a just alternative, Washington will not be swayed. André must be hanged. On October 2, 1780, as Benedict Arnold enjoys the safety and luxury of his new life as a British officer in New York City, Major John André is led to the gallows just before noon. A length of wood has been laid in the branches of two trees, forming the crosspiece from which André will hang. He wears his British military uniform as he steps up into the back of a wagon, upon which an open pine casket already awaits. The hangman adjusts the rope around his neck. A white handkerchief is tied around André's head as a blindfold. "All I request of you, gentlemen, is that while I acknowledge the propriety of my sentence, you will bear me witness that I die like a brave man." Then, adding his final words, André concludes his short life. "It will be but a momentary pang." With the flick of a whip, the horse-drawn wagon surges forward, leaving Major André swinging in midair. He is dead within minutes.